You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the legislature's budget writing committee had its third hearing on the governor's budget proposal. We'll find out what happened with a WPR reporter on the scene. First, the number of immigrant families detained while trying to enter the U.S. illegally has spiked in recent years, with 2019 on pace to see even more apprehensions than last year. Many of those arriving at the border come from agricultural regions in Central America, where more extreme and unpredictable weather is making it difficult to earn a living from the land. Our next guest spent time reporting in western Guatemala and found that while people have a lot of reasons for leaving their home and traveling north, many of them stem from a changing climate. Jonathan Blitzer is a staff writer at The New Yorker. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, John, I think a lot of focus is on people coming from high-crime urban areas in Central America. You found a different part of the story in this agricultural part of western Guatemala. Set the scene there for us.
Sure. And I'm glad that you make the qualification, too, that there is violence driving a lot of people from this region as well. I was just zeroing in on people who are fleeing Guatemala because of hunger, because of deep entrenched poverty, all of which has been exacerbated in recent years by climate change. So I was visiting small villages in the western highlands of Guatemala, trying to get a sense of how in people's day-to-day lives, climate change was impacting their livelihood and forcing them to abandon their land. And what I was finding was that there were a whole host of factors that have to do with the climate that are forcing people out. So for example, rains that typically come in May and June are coming much later. Rains coming irregularly poses a real problem for subsistence farmers because they can't plan their harvests. And so often they have whole crops destroyed by things like that. There are droughts that are lasting longer than ever before. There is more humidity that affects the soil and leads to the growth of new funguses and pests that destroy crops. There are spikes in temperature followed by drastic drops in temperature. All of this kind of irregularity is basically forcing people who grow things like potatoes, maize, vegetables, not just to sell in local markets, but also for their own food. All of this stuff is forcing those people to abandon their harvests and to try to seek some sort of relief in the U.S.
And if I'm reading your reporting right, even in ideal weather conditions, these are people who might just be getting by.
That's right. I mean, these are we're talking about areas that are extremely poor and extremely vulnerable to these kinds of swings in climate because in changing climate because, you know, I was in places at a very high altitude. And so there's a limited number of crops that people are able to grow at these altitudes. And so the fact of what's happened in recent years has really made a precarious situation much worse.
You talked to people who had tried coming north and been deported, or family members of people who had successfully made it in the U.S. Can you talk about what kind of factors they are weighing in making that decision to give up on the farm there and make that difficult journey?
You know, on the U.S. side of the border, we tend to think that if we make entry into the U.S. harder, if the U.S. government makes it much more difficult to enter through more punitive policies, through increased enforcement, that somehow that will weigh on people's decisions to leave in the first place. And what I found, and what a lot of colleagues of mine and other reporters have found, is that people who are fleeing for their lives, whether it's because of violence or because of hunger, don't really have much of a choice, aren't thinking that far ahead. The people I was meeting were not doing much more than weighing strategies for how to make their journey. It was no longer really a question of whether or not they should do it, or even for that matter, when, but rather how. And in terms of why the people I was meeting were making those decisions in the ways that they did, it was quite simply because they had nothing. Their crops were not coming to harvest. They were losing money every time they tried to grow them. Many of the families I spoke to were actually hungry, had gone days without eating. It was that level of desperation that was forcing people to travel north.
Talking to Jonathan Blitzer, staff writer at The New Yorker, talking about his reporting from Guatemala and how climate change, difficult farming conditions is driving many people to try to make their way to the United States. And John, for those people who stayed there, talk about the role that remittances played when that person comes to the United States and sends money back.
Absolutely. It's a complex phenomenon because obviously we're talking about major spikes in immigration over the last few years, but there's been pretty steady levels of immigration. immigration to the United States, at least since the late 1970s. And the trend has essentially just increased and now recently spiked. And what that means is that in a lot of these communities, there are either family members, friends, neighbors who have reached the United States. And when they do reach the United States, many of them arrive with the expectation that they'll spend maybe a few years in the U.S., they'll earn enough money in the U.S. to eventually build a house back home, to begin to buy land for their family back home. And frequently what happens is that people end up staying in the U.S., or for a variety of reasons, kind of get caught between the two countries. But the amount of money that flows back to Guatemala every year in the form of remittances is staggering. It's 11% of the gross domestic product of the country. It's much more money than what the U.S. used to contribute to Guatemala in the form of international aid. It's gotten to a point where in certain communities, the success of a local economy almost seems to depend on how many people living in that community were actually able to reach the U.S. and therefore pay for their families' needs and costs remotely in the form of remittances. So the whole remittance economy is a real dominant force in the local economies and livelihoods of these people. And it's one of the reasons why ties between the U.S. and Guatemala remain so strong.
And back a few years ago, farmers in the area you visited worked with a program that was funded in part by the U.S. That tried to help help people adjust to changing weather patterns, to changing climate. What kind of programs did you see that had come out of that?
Well, when I went, the president of the U.S. hadn't yet threatened to completely cut aid in the way that he did in recent weeks. And so I was looking at a few places where communities were still being supported by local, national, and in some cases, international NGOs doing all kinds of things. Where I was, essentially, communities were getting help with the diversification of crops. As temperatures and climate was changing in some of these places, it was increasingly important for members of the community to learn to plant different crops that were more adaptable to the changing climate, and also to use different strategies, for example, to plant their crops in different ways, taking advantage of patches of sun and shade, increasingly trying to reforest parts of these mountainsides that had been increasingly deforested over the years. One of the places where I spent a lot of time, a tiny hamlet called Paraje León in the Western Highlands, there was a small program that was funded in large part by money from the U.S. State Department that over the course of a three-year span amounted to about $190,000, which from the U.S.'s standpoint is absolutely a tiny amount. I mean, a drop in the bucket in terms of American expenditure in the region. And this money went such a long way in this particular community in helping community members begin to diversify their crops and improve just the sort of environmental factors where they lived, that a significant number of people did not emigrate as a result, whereas in the past they may have been more inclined to head to the U.S. when their crops died. This program was wound down by the Trump administration in 2017 because of the Trump administration's hostility to initiatives related to climate change. And so, unfortunately, even programs that saw major gains over the last few years and that were reproducible and that were quite cheap to implement are no longer getting the backing of the U.S. government.
What kind of crops were people starting to switch to under this program?
There were things like, I mean, one of the strangest things I have to say about being in this particular area was that we were standing at maybe 9 or 10,000 feet above sea level, and you can see everything from apples to maize to citrus fruits, which almost never can be grown at those kinds of altitudes, coffee in some cases. These were all signs, in fact, of how significant climate change has affected the region. But these were the kinds of things that community members were increasingly encouraged to try to plant, and they were given the seeds to do so. They began to use greenhouses to grow things like tomatoes and flowers. So they were not just creating food for themselves, but they were also beginning to grow things that allowed them to make small sales in local markets. And that was the kind of advantage of having this direction. I mean, there were trained agronomists, forestry experts. All of them were coming to this town on more or less a weekly basis over the course of a few years.
As we wrap up, John, as you talk to people in Western Guatemala, did you get the impression that staying there, if they could, was the first choice and that migrating was a last resort?
I think that's right. I think no one wants to leave home. I think the situation on the ground has gotten to a point where there's such direness and such desperation that people have little choice. And so when the question is simply a question of when you're going to leave and not whether or not you'll leave, then, you know, I think you're already looking at a landscape that's been pretty badly decimated by that expectation that there's really no hope in staying. But the people I met did not. I mean, these are people who very much wanted to stay where they were. A lot of them only traveled reluctantly. Some of them had traveled before, got apprehended, deported, but had incurred such debts in having made the trip the first time that they had to keep trying in order to get U.S. wages to pay off these debts. All of those people would say to me, I just want to find work here. I just want more or less stable wages here. I would be very happy to stay here. That was mostly what I was hearing.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jonathan Blitzer, staff writer at The New Yorker. He was with us to talk about the ways that climate change is driving much of the migration out of Central American countries in rural parts of Guatemala and neighboring nations. He shared some of his reporting from Guatemala with us. Coming up, we'll check out the latest hearing on Governor Evers' proposed budget. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, older and younger generations can remind us of all the change that can happen in our world in a pretty short amount of time. But is the generation gap getting bigger? A psychologist shares her research, and you can join the conversation. First, today is tax day, and in River Falls, Wisconsinites are telling the legislature's budget writing committee what programs they want their state tax dollars going towards. The Joint Finance Committee held its third meeting on Governor Evers' proposed budget today at UW River Falls, a budget that state Republicans have criticized and said they may scrap altogether. Rich Kramer is a WPR News reporter based in Eau Claire. He's been covering the meeting, and he joins us now from River Falls. Rich, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, on this tour, there've been pretty long days of testimony. Paint us a picture. How did this all work, Rich?
Well, it's still in process, as far as I know. I jumped out to be able to talk to you just now, but they were still taking testimony, so they started at 10 in the morning. I heard from one of the staffers that there were at least 190 some odd people that had signed up to testify, and from what it looks like, they're listening to every single one of them.
And for those of us, Rich, who haven't been to one of these kind of events, do the lawmakers start out with a spiel? Do they have some things to say about their budget priorities, or do they just throw the door open and start hearing from constituents?
Well, if you're a member of the media, they give you a spiel before the meeting, but generally they introduce the chancellor who is hosting the meeting today, and they just talk about the importance and then how they appreciate everyone coming out to give the give their thoughts on this budget. It's a very important process that they all go through. And but before the hearing started, members of the Joint Finance Committee, Democrats and Republicans, did make themselves available to media. And what I heard from Republicans is that, you know, they're concerned about keeping taxes low, especially when the economy is doing well. They don't want to stifle that. And Democrats, meanwhile, talked about how they need to invest in certain key areas, namely expanding the state's Medicaid program, Badger Care, and accepting the federal money to do that.
And we have a budget proposal from Governor Evers. Republicans have talked about, and they have the majority, of course, on the Budget Committee and in the legislature, they have talked about ignoring that and coming up with their own plan. Did any of those leaders earlier today talk about whether or not they'd start with the governor's plan or go it alone?
Well, I didn't ask that. What I did ask is that, you know, there's a number of things that we've seen at these other meetings that have been held, the two meetings already. I'd say a majority of people are asking to accept, you know, allow Governor Evers' plan to accept the Medicaid funds and expand the program, and that would unleash hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funding. So I mentioned this to the Republican members and said, you know, people want this. They also, the recent polling from Marquette University shows that a big majority of people want this. But basically what they told me is that they there's no hunger whatsoever for them to do that. And John Nygren, who's one of the co-chairs of the Joint Finance Committee, actually said, you know, if they would have framed that question different in the polling and said, would you like to expand welfare programs? He said that they don't, he wouldn't have expected the same result from respondents. So there is kind of a gulf between what at least the majority of the people at these meetings have been saying and what Republican lawmakers seem to be comfortable with.
I want to listen to somebody who testified before the committee on that issue, Rich. Here's Tammy Davis of Eau Claire calling on lawmakers to expand Medicaid and take that federal money. And of course, it's known as Badger Care here in Wisconsin.
It is safe to say that Badger Care has saved my life numerous times. Despite all that I have experienced, I still possess the desire to lift myself and my family out of systemic poverty. However, I am currently unable to take positions that pay more than the federal poverty line because of limitations previously imposed on Badger Care recipients.
Rich, did we hear other people? You mentioned that a lot of people talked about this at previous hearings. Did a lot of people go to this issue today as well?
They sure did. Yeah, I would say that if there were one major theme, it was expanding Badger Care or accepting the federal Medicaid funds. I mean, you heard it from many different angles. There were people that were kind of representing the mental health provider community. You know, you also heard from some hospital people who were talking about, you know, that would help them as well in terms of, you know, having some more people with some sort of funding to help pay for their emergency room visits. And so, yeah, I would say that was number one. And number two would have to be public K-12 education funding.
What kind of things were people saying about school funding?
Well, the one thing that popped up over and over again had to do with special education funding. And this was coming from district superintendents and school board members. What I heard over and over again is that school districts in western Wisconsin, they were talking about having to transfer annually millions of dollars from their regular budget into special education programming. They made it sound like these were mandated services that the legislature ordered them to provide, but yet the legislature hasn't increased funding. So I heard the word unfunded mandate a couple times. That was interesting.
Talking to WPR reporter Rich Kramer. He's in River Falls today at a Joint Finance Committee hearing on the state budget. A testimony still going on as we speak. Rich, there's also some testimony on Governor Evers' plan to fund roads by eliminating what's known as the minimum markup law that the governor says would balance out a gas tax increase. Here's Tony Huppert, who operates a convenience and supply store in Spring Valley.
This proposal in its present form will not save customers any money and will harm mom-and-pop businesses from predatory pricing by huge corporations. And it is jeopardizing the emergency refined fuel storage of the state of Wisconsin. We believe repealing the Unfair Sales Act does not belong in the budget.
Rich, we heard a lot about road issues in the last budget go-round and in the election for governor. Is this something that came up a lot today, roads and how to pay for them?
Yes. Well, I heard it a few times, not as much as I would have thought. I mean, we heard the drumbeat a lot during the run-up to the last year's election, the 2018 November election. But today I heard one person who was speaking on behalf of petroleum basically gas station, you know, companies that sell gas, they weren't necessarily opposed to increasing the gas tax, but they didn't want to get rid of the minimum markup law on gas, too. They said that that could hurt mom-and-pop gas stations around the state. But I really didn't hear a lot. I heard some city administrators say that they'd like increased funding for their own, you know, roads projects, but it didn't stand out as much as I thought it would.
We've talked about Medicaid expansion, education, road funding. Rich, what are some other big issues that kept coming up today?
Well, you know, River Falls, the campus here is very much centered on agriculture. So We heard from, you know, maybe a handful of people about the need to increase funding for research into agriculture. That, you know, we heard some farmers talking about the really poor milk prices that they've been facing for a couple of years, more than that, actually. But there was some kind of dairy discovery program that they wanted to see funding. I believe it was $8 million for that program. But there's just only a smattering on that front.
One issue that we hear about sometimes from rural parts of the states is broadband access, access to high-speed internet. It's got a lot of buzz from some politicians. Is this something that any constituents pointed toward today?
Not really. But again, I'm trying to summarize like five-plus hours of testimony here. And I was jotting down notes, but I did not hear much of that. It didn't jump out at me.
All right, Rich, we'll let you get back to cover the conclusion of the hearing. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I've been talking to Rich Kramer. He's a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. He joined us now from River Falls to talk about a joint finance committee hearing held there today on Governor Evers' proposed budget plan. This is part of a multi-stop tour of the state's budget writing committee to hear from constituents. Then they will have to decide whether or not they'll take Governor Evers' budget as the starting point or ignore that and come up with their own plan for the state budget. We'll talk about that plenty more in the months to come here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, how different is your life compared to your grandparents when they were your age? We'll talk with a psychologist about today's generation gap and what factors define today's people, young and old. And some people think that the generation gap is getting bigger than it used to be. We'll try to figure out if that's true. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show, Native Americans have been at the center of conflicts over the environment for centuries. Kate Archer-Kent talks to the author of the new book, As Long as Grass Grows, The Indigenous Fight for Environmental Justice from Colonization to Standing Rock. That's tomorrow at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, different generations tend to have different defining characteristics over the years, but today's generational divide often feels like it gets more attention. Things like housing, pensions, job security, education, how we vote, the culture we consume, how we use the internet, what we value, can all produce different thoughts depending on your age. Are today's differences between the young and old actually unusual, more so than they've been in the past, or do we just notice them more? Dr. Jean Twenge is professor of psychology at San Diego State University. She researches and writes about generational differences. Her latest book is called iGen, Why Today's Super-Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. Jean, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, we focused, Jean, last time you were on the show on your book, but this question of the generation gap. Is there a way to measure whether the generation gap is bigger over time or smaller?
Well, we can look at some of the things that you mentioned in terms of how people spend their time and how they're feeling and what they value and how that differs from one generation to the next. So kind of as a general conclusion, there was clearly a pretty big generation gap between the baby boomers, those born mid-1940s to mid-1960s, and their parents. So the Silent Generation and the GI Generation who fought World War II. So definite generational break there, mostly around values, because the baby boomers were really kind of questioning a lot of things about corporate America and about the Vietnam War and about how much we should follow rules versus pursue, you know, your own personal passions. Then since then, there have certainly been generational differences through Gen Xers and millennials, basically a growth of those same attitudes in terms of individualism, more focus on the self. And then there was another generational break, much more recently, between the millennials born in the 80s and early 90s and the generation born after 1995 that I call iGen.
We see the pace of technological change. It feels like, and I think it's true, it gets faster and faster over time. The time from a new big thing becoming obsolete and a new thing taking over for it gets faster. Is that part of what's driving this, what feels like a bigger gap between generations?
It certainly looks that way. So the biggest shifts, and this is mostly teens, 13 to 19-year-olds roughly, the biggest shifts occur around 2011 or 2012. That is right as the smartphone became common. So around that time, we switched from pretty high levels of happiness and low levels of depression among teens to much more depression, much more unhappiness. It's also around the same time that the amount of time teens started to spend with their friends face-to-face, that had been declining for a while, but not by much, and then it really accelerated right at that time that communication moved onto the smartphone. So technology does seem to have accelerated some of these generational shifts, and that shift was much more sudden than a lot of shifts in the past, which took, you know, a decade or two to roll out. In this case, it was because a smartphone took only 5 years from its introduction to 50% of Americans having one, so it was a really sudden shift.
When I think of the generation gap, I think of a gap in maybe understanding or empathy between generations. You know, kids these days versus old people don't understand, parents don't understand. Do you see that kind of basic understanding gap on the rise? We just don't get each other across generations.
That's certainly possible. We don't have a lot of great data on that because the data I'm drawing from is mostly young people themselves rather than,
sure,
you know, perceptions of older folks. But, you know, there's certainly a lot of concern around technology and young people spending too much time on technology. You know, on the other hand, a lot of older people are concerned about their own technology use as well. So, you know, in some ways, that's a generational universal. But it is certainly true that the way teens are growing up now is so fundamentally different from the way their parents' generation, Gen Xers and Boomers, grew up, that there is a real generation gap around, you know, what teenagers are doing with their time, say, you know, looking at their phone as opposed to what Gen Xers like me remember of, you know, going to the mall or going out with your friends, which just isn't as common anymore.
Talking to Gene Twenge, professor of psychology at San Diego State University, author of the book iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. We're talking about the generation gap as it exists today and how it might have changed over time. Gene, let's focus now on this iGen for a few moments. We've spent a lot more time on it in the past. There are, you write in your book, some upsides. They seem to be drinking less, doing fewer drugs. Teen pregnancy is down. All good news. But you do worry, and you were touching on this a little bit, you see some downsides, especially when it comes to our relationships.
Yeah, so the biggest downside, in my view, which is very concerning, is this sudden increase in depression and suicide risk factors that began around 2011 or 2012. It has just continued throughout the most recent data. It's now reached levels that are really, really concerning. So one out of five teen girls has had clinical level depression in the past year. That is very concerning. And that wasn't true just in 2010, just 9 years ago. There's some other trends that are more trade-offs. So one of the biggest generation gaps is that iGen is less likely, say when they're 18, to have a driver's license, to work at a paid job, to go out without their parents, to date, to drink alcohol, to have sex. Some of those are trends that most parents are thrilled about, that fewer teens are having sex and drinking alcohol. But there's also those trends in there which are not clearly good or bad, like being less likely to have a driver's license or a job. And it just points toward iGen taking longer to grow up, which has some real advantages, but has some downsides too. One of which is their Gen X parents are saying, what do you mean you don't want to have a driver's license? Are you crazy? And that's one of the things parents comment to me, that they're surprised when they see these trends, but then they say, oh, that explains my kid and his friends and why they're so different from what I remember being a teen.
For the clearly negative parts of iGen, especially the increased rates of depression, not strong in-person relationships, what's the therapy? What is the answer to some of those concerns?
You know, I in some ways, this may end up being a good news story, because if these trends can be traced even partially to the overuse of technology, then the solution is very clear. Then we can cut back on our use of technology. And that doesn't mean giving up our phones or tablets or laptops. It just means being more mindful about how we use our leisure time and helping our kids do the same. So what that's going to look like is things such as no phones or tablets in the bedroom after lights out to preserve sleep, because getting enough sleep, very important for mental health and happiness. Not looking at the phone or tablet right before bed so it doesn't interfere with sleep. And just trying to limit the amount of time we spend looking at a screen to 2 hours a day or less, maybe three on an odd day, but for it not to take over all of our leisure time and for that phone not to be in our hand all the time, to preserve time for sleep, for exercise, and for face-to-face social interaction. That, as parents, we have to realize, well, we think, you know, if they're at home alone on their phone in their bedroom that they're safe. Well, physically, maybe, but it's not great for their mental health. It would actually be better for their mental health, more than likely, if they were out with their friends. Even though that runs the risk of them, you know, getting into trouble, that may be the downside. But that face-to-face social interaction is so crucial for mental health and for developing important social skills.
You mentioned that older generations are latching on to various forms of technology. I know, at least anecdotally, it seems like younger people are seeing Facebook as the preserve of their parents and older generations. We've seen concerns from older people about stress related to too much time online, reports on seniors being susceptible to fake news online. Are you worried about some of the similar effects you see in the youngest generation as older generations embrace this technology, have the same stuff?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely something to think about. What's interesting is, in a recent study, we were able to look at some of these mental health trends around depression and psychological distress and suicide risk factors. And we found that that pronounced increase in those factors after 2011 only appeared among teens and young adults. Adults ages 26 and over didn't really show these trends. I mean, there were a few weak effects, but it wasn't anything close to that clear increase that showed up with younger people. So it could be that older people's social lives are more established, that even though they're spending more time in technology, maybe it's not enough to have really disrupted their social lives, as opposed to younger people where the norm has shifted so much toward electronic communication that they're not getting together with each other face-to-face as much.
Talking to Dr. Jean Twenge, professor of psychology at San Diego State University. She researches and writes about generational differences. Her latest book is called iGen, Why Today's Superconnected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. We're talking about the generation gap and different ways of understanding the world between the iGen that she writes about and millennials, Gen Xers, baby boomers, and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Whichever generation you are in, tell us about a time when you've noticed generational differences. Maybe it's at the workplace, the family, the school. What do you feel defines your generation, whichever one it is? Are there ways you don't see eye to eye with different generations? Are there things you see the younger generations doing or experiencing that you wish you could have had, or that maybe they think you think they've taken it too far in that direction? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with psychology professor Jean Twenge. Her newest book is called iGen, Why Today's Superconnected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. We're talking about the generation gap and whether it's gotten bigger over time. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you have trouble understanding another generation that you work with, live with, interact with? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Gene, based on your research, do you have thoughts on how maybe, especially with the iGen, how based on what we know about them and each other, how we can get along across generations and kind of make sense of the experiences of each other?
Yeah, you know, I think your point earlier about understanding is just really key, that to just, you know, when you're relating to someone, just realize, you know, their world is very different from the one that you might have experienced growing up. And to try to take another person's perspective, always very helpful, but perhaps especially around generational differences. So even though I'm of the opinion that, you know, being on the phone all the time is not a great thing, still, when I see young people on their phone, I try to remember that that's become the standard, that their friends, it may not even occur to them, hey, let's call each other on the phone or, you know, get together face-to-face, because the norm has shifted so much away from that. They want to talk to their friends, may not have any other choice than to be on Instagram or Snapchat or send a text, because they just don't have that standard of let's go get together with people face-to-face.
Let's bring on a caller now. Ellen is with us in Green Bay. Ellen, hello.
Hello. So I myself am a member of iGen, and I found that for those who have depression, they use their phones as a coping mechanism.
How so, Ellen?
So I've heard from some of my friends that when they're feeling more depressed, or they have worse feelings about themselves, they go on their phone and they look at what other people are doing, and they look at other jokes and things online.
Ellen, thanks for the call and for sharing the experiences of your peers. Gene, is that something you saw as you talked with and studied people as part of that generation?
Yeah, if you look at the studies, especially the big studies, they do tend to show that people who spend, especially an excessive amount of time online, so that's going to be 3-4 hours a day or more, they are more likely to be depressed and unhappy. So then the question is, what causes what? And it seems to be, a lot of times it's kind of a vicious cycle, that sometimes you do get the pattern of someone who's depressed will then spend more time online, but then that time online doesn't have the effect that they would like. It doesn't make them happier. It sometimes can, but when it gets to that higher level, you know, the 3 hours, 4 hours a day and beyond, then it doesn't, because it tends to replace activities that would be more beneficial for getting rid of depression or unhappiness, like sleeping or exercise or face-to-face social interaction, because those we know from decades of research are better for mental health. So it's kind of a vicious cycle in a lot of ways, that you have both going on. But in a longer time scale, most of the studies that have followed people and longitudinal studies tend to find that it's the screen time that leads to depression rather than the other way around. But you do get both.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Lucas with us in Waukesha now. Lucas, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about Lucas?
I'm a teacher in a district in southeastern Wisconsin, and we have technology in the classroom all the time, and I'm in elementary school. And you see, while it can be super useful for educational purposes, you see how they kind of recede into themselves when they get those iPads in their hands, and how social interaction becomes kind of secondary. And sometimes I worry that we're losing some of those social skills when we're always having an iPad in their hand, or when we're having an iPad in their hand when they could be working with their classmates.
Lucas, thanks a lot for that call. So, Gene, it's not just that personal cell phone. Lucas sees it in, you know, the school's putting iPads and other devices in the kids' hands.
Yeah, that's right. And I see it as a college faculty member as well, that in the classroom, people have out their laptop and are kind of hiding behind it and don't talk to their classmates as much as they used to before that was the standard. So it's such a trade-off, and it's such a difficult thing, especially in education, that we, you know, obviously want our students to learn how to use the current technology, and we have so much access to information. I mean, it's such a boon for education in so many ways, yet we have to make sure, again, I think that it's that balance, not using it so much that they're missing out on that face-to-face social interaction. And that's often a very tough balance to strike in a classroom, I agree.
Thanks for the call, Lucas. Terry joins us now in Milwaukee. Terry, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Love your show. I appreciate this topic especially. I was speaking to the person who answered the phone. I was born in 65, and in 1985, I was literally stuck in Poland. I'm first-generation American, and I do not know how we did it, but my dad was here in the United States, and there was no cell phone. There was just, you know, the old-fashioned long-distance call, and I made it back, but man, oh, man, and just even I was saying back in the day, meeting at Summerfest, you don't make it to the water tower by 10 o'clock, you're gone. You're not going to wait any longer. And I'm also an early childhood special ed teacher, and I call my group time old school carpet time. We do not use the smart board at that time. I put in a CD. We all look at each other and we sing. They absolutely love it.
Terry, thanks a lot for that call. Okay, I like that. The carpet group singing time, Gene, a way to have that face-to-face interaction.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot of worries right now about preschoolers and toddlers spending so much time with tablets, because that wasn't the case even 5 years ago. It wasn't as common. And I hear from a lot of kindergarten teachers and preschool teachers that kids are almost starving for that face-to-face social interaction. So it's wonderful to hear that being incorporated very purposely into the school day.
And also, Terry mentioned the meetup. I mean, in some ways, I'll say in my life, the cell phone makes it easier, especially when you're in another city and try to meet up with people. It's easier to pull off that difficult logistical act of being in the same place at the same time. Can we harness this in a way that is socially positive and brings us together?
Absolutely. I mean, that's kind of the irony, isn't it? That you could completely see it going the other way. Now that we have smartphones, maybe it should be easier for us to coordinate meeting up face-to-face. And that, at least for young people, has not been the direction that it's gone. But I think that shows that question of balance again, that it's not the technology, it's how we use the technology, and that we can use it to facilitate get-togethers and other things that are great and convenient and wonderful. It's when staring at the screen replaces these things that we run into trouble.
Thanks for the call, Terry. We'll go now to Marie with us in Jefferson. Marie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a speech therapist, and I've noticed that I feel like kind of piggybacking off of the woman that spoke before that, you know, you see a lot of young kids, even in grocery carts, that are looking at iPads. And instead of having that interaction and being able to look at facial expressions and talk about what you're seeing in the grocery store, it's more of sitting still, looking at the iPad, not having any of that back and forth language. And it's really affecting kids' ability to express themselves even at a young age now.
Marie, thanks for that call. So, Gene, it's not necessarily the teens here. It's the parents parenting based on these devices. In our last minute or so, leave us with some thoughts on that.
Yeah, so that I think is the worry for even the post-iGen generation is what's going to happen to those language skills. And again, that's something I hear a lot from people who work with young kids, that they are afraid first, that kids aren't going to develop the language skills, and second, that they won't develop the self-control to go out to a restaurant without the tablet in front of their faces. So that's the next generation, the next worry.
Marie, thanks for that call. And Gene, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you.
Gene Twenge is a professor of psychology at San Diego State University. She researches and writes about generational differences. Her latest book is iGen, Why Today's Superconnected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. She joined us to talk about today's generation gap. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, President Trump says he's thinking about sending asylum seekers to self-declared sanctuary cities around the country. We'll look at the politics behind that story. Milwaukee County has set its sights on a new public health crisis, racism. We'll find out why and what local leaders are hoping to accomplish. And we'll check out a series of historic Yiddish recordings housed at the UW-Madison, now going on to the National Registry of Sounds. That and more, all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, Kate and her guests look at the latest efforts to preserve and revitalize downtown districts and communities around Wisconsin. That's coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll check out life on the open road in a recreational vehicle, or RV. We'll learn about the history of RV culture, find out why millennials are getting on board, and we'll ask for your stories. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.